I'm wearing my Boston Celtics shirt.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
You know why?
I know why.
Do you? Or are you a fair weather fan?
This year, I've been very much a fair weather fan. I've watched the Celtics for 5 years.
I
root for them like crazy. And then the year
you're part of the reason I'm a Celtics fan.
What?
You're part of the reason I'm a Celtics fan.
And then I have a kid and I completely give up watching NBA.
Did you know that they were in the finals?
Yes, I didn't know that they were in the finals. And I have watched, I usually watch all the playoff games and I haven't watched all of them. I watch a few Celtics ones.
They've been good.
Yeah. I mean, they're awesome.
Yeah.
So you really made the finals.
Yeah, I know. Playoffs have been awesome. Well, Al Horford's finally making it too. Everyone's like, yeah, he was in college when I was. He was a Gator, and he won 2 national championships when I was at UF, and he's never made it to the finals. He's like, isn't he old? I'm like, yep, he is.
I like how this started off with, he was in college when I was, and he's just making the finals now. Yeah. Like, what have you done since then? What the hell am I
doing? Exactly. No, but it's cool. I mean, you know, to hit that level in your college and then go so long in the NBA without ever even getting to the finals.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to have a tough time versus Golden State, obviously, but still pretty cool.
Oh, man. Like, I love that Golden State team. They've been plagued by injuries.
Yeah.
I love that team.
I know.
I always root for them when they are in the finals. So it's going to be.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Yeah. It should be good.
I'm rooting for the Celtics.
Yeah, so. Of course. First year of the new coach, too.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've been busy with some things. We've been doing some consulting. We've been making some videos, been working on our course. Let's kick it off. I'll just talk quickly about the video I made last week. It was pretty fun. Rolled up my sleeves and did some D3 code. It's been a while. I wanted it for the app we've both been using, actually. It's like the most useful app I've ever made, I think. I use it every day at the gym. It's the new gym one. Finally found a gym fitness-related app I actually use all the time. But added a little graph here to the exercises. And I started off by using like a chart library because I really was hacking on like a Saturday night and just wanted to get it in there. And the same thing that always happens is you want to make some tweaks. You know, and it was interesting because I made that calendar YouTube video a few weeks ago, and that did pretty well on YouTube. People seemed to like it, and it was fun because you're building with like these super low level libraries, like obviously using Tailwind on all my projects these days, but the DataFN's library and just making a calendar out of those things, whereas normally I would reach for a calendar library. Like, obviously that's what you would think of because it's so hard, but those libraries make it so easy. And then with the charting thing, it's the same idea. I mean, I used D3 by itself in the past. When I got started in JavaScript, that's like one of the libraries I reached for because I was just doing like data visualization stuff. But I wanted to customize it. And I also wanted to compose it with the DataFN stuff and Frame of Motion because we've been doing a lot of animation stuff lately. So I did the first pass with like Observable Plot, which was like this new higher level charting library from the folks who make and maintain D3. It was fine. It's like use effect. You plot.render and then you like ref.append. I was like, we don't want that kind of stuff. That's rubbish. You know, that's like integrating Jake. It's not rubbish. It's just, it doesn't feel like you're writing React.
Wait, what do you mean by ref.append?
So like the observable plot. Imagine you had jQuery chart and you wanted to add it to your React app.
Oh, you create
get a ref on your div, and then you get the div.
And you append
something. Yeah, container. Current.
Yeah, dot append. It's not React.
It's not React.
Yeah. You can say it's rubbish.
Yeah, it's rubbish.
Yeah.
And so, basically brought D3 in, but, I wanted to animate the path. So I knew I had to render like a path element. My goal with the animations was to draw the path. I had just learned that in Frame of Motion, they have this animated property that they have called path length. And it's like a small abstraction over stroke offset and stroke dash array, which are two properties you can use on SVG elements to simulate animating a path. There's no support for that notion in SVG, but by tweaking those in a certain way, you can simulate it. And Frame of Motion does that for you, which is awesome because path length takes a property from 0 to 1 and then it just animates it as a percentage. Super cool.
It's actually really cool how it does it because the dash array takes your SVG and makes a stroke a bunch of dashes. It's like if you do like a
dotted border line
with a dash
right.
in HTML.
Right.
And so you make a bunch of dashes and then you change the space between the dashes.
The offset.
And the offset yeah. at the same time yeah. to simulate.
You're growing a segment of a the stroke. Dash.
Yeah.
Right.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, pretty cool. And yeah. I had, you know, the rings that I had in, that I use in fitness app, I actually have those calculated now. It's just like so silly. I was actually using frame of motion to calculate those. I calculate those as like a circumference. All I had to do was have a ring and just set path
length. Oh, a ring that's length. A dash and then
not even, the just stroke. A ring as a stroke and then and do then path length point. Path length. Path length is literally goals over total and that's it. So right now I have like those weird properties. I don't even need those at all.
Good video for you.
Yeah, actually. Refactoring. Yep.
Just yeah, talking about
just knowing path length yeah, exists, path length, you yep. know? So I started with that path and then I was like, oh, I can render a line chart. If I render it as a React element, which path is, then I can make it a motion.path with frame of motion and then animate this offset and have like a line graph that animates. And then I remember last time I used D3, you know, they had broken it all up into composable modules like years ago. So you can just call like d3.line and then generate the D attribute and then slap it right on your React element and then use motion.path. So I wanted to see all these pieces working together. Turns out a few other people have done this as well. So it's cool to see that. But there's still no like I found blog posts from people who were in the D3 community saying like, oh, when I use React, like I don't even use D3 append, D3 update, D3 select. Which have actually always been the most confusing parts of D3 because those parts have to exist because D3 has to work anywhere. But if you're in React, you already have a way to append and render and update elements. So now you literally are just, you know, just like if you were rendering a text, like a div or like a list and you had an array of objects, you iterate over it, but you just let React render the thing. You let React render the path and you just use D3 to calculate the line attribute, which draws the line graph based on the data.
Cool.
And it's just part of render and it's like super clean and easy. So there's only like 10 or 20 lines of D3 code and the rest is React. And then you switch it from path to motion, not path. And then you can animate to your heart's content. I even animate like little circles. You can make them go up. You know, you could do all sorts of things. Like I want to make it eventually when there's a lot of data, you're like zoomed out. So you can click like last 3 months, last year and everything like shifts, just but it keeps nice. It, you know? So it's pretty neat. It's nice to be work. It's always nice to be working at that level where you have complete control over it. So, yeah, that was cool. I put that up on YouTube. People liked it. People said that they were glad I took some more time on explaining D3 because they had never done it before. And it is very intense. Even today, I went to the homepage. I had a lot of experience with it again, a couple of years ago, the API hasn't changed much, but even still having to look up examples and figure out how things work. So how, if you've never used D3 before, I make sure to explain it as if you had never heard of it before. So you might find that beneficial.
Cool. Yeah. The select, how data always flows through and there's like an update.
Yeah.
I don't know. I actually always have to ask you.
Yeah.
So that's my answer.
You know, it's the same idea as like, I mean, even frame of motion has like initial animate and exit. It was the same idea with D3 joins where it's like select, update, and remove. So they like the sub selections of the data that's changed and you give each DOM node an identity. And if it's still there, it's going to update to its new position. If it's not there anymore, you know, after you reselect it, it leaves and it runs this exit animation. So it's the same idea. It's just we already have React. And so if there's something leaving, you can just use exit with frame of motion. If there's something entering, you can just use initial with frame of motion. So that's it. You're done.
Pretty cool.
And because frame of motion can animate like every attribute on SVG and elements, like you don't need to use data joins in D3 anymore. So it's pretty sweet.
Nice.
Yeah. So that was my video last week. And yeah, we'll put a link to it if people want to check it out. There was one more frame of motion thing we had. You were talking about the exit animations and how they lead to better React code.
Yeah. I don't know if better, but like more like I've noticed this with frame of motion. So frame of motion has this component animate presence and it kind of tracks when elements are coming in or out. And when they're coming out, you can give them an exit animation. Yeah. So they like fade out. Something like that. They move off the screen.
Right.
And the component that you're animating out actually gets removed from the from your React tree. Mm-hmm. And I think Frame of Motion just snapshots its HTML and keeps it like visually keeps it around. I actually think it clones a component. Yeah. It doesn't, it's more than just snapshotting the HTML. It actually clones a component because if you have a hook in the component, that hook will rerun mm-hmm. while your component's animating out. Hmm. So it keeps it like clones your component, keeps it around, and then animates it out. And then by the time your component's done animating out, it's actually removed from the tree. Mm-hmm. And I noticed with like other animation libraries I've used, you because like if you have like a ternary that unrenders a component, you don't have any time to apply any sort of animation. Like React unrenders it, it's gone. So there's like a strategy where you keep the component always rendered. It's mm-hmm. just like wrapped in a div with like mm-hmm. display none. So the component doesn't have a life cycle.
So if you like is showing modal, maybe if you were just writing without animations, you would do is showing modal and exactly. modal.
Exactly.
And then you want to add animations. And a lot of times they make you say modal always rendered. And then you like is showing and exactly. you pass an is showing modal. And that way the animation library can render it on and off. Like right. with CSS trans, you could use CSS transitions or yep. something like that.
Yep. Exactly.
But because as soon as you unrender it, React takes it out of the DOM and there's no chance to animate it away.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate the Frame of Motion approach. I notice that it I don't have to think about, oh, my component's always rendered. Yeah, I love that my component gets lifecycle and I don't have to like give it extra time to
hang around. Yeah, we ran into this when
it's really cool.
It is really cool. I mean, it's like, well, we ran into this when we were working on a project last year at some point and they had this pattern and then we switched it to using actual mounting and unmounting. And then we brought in Animate Presence so we could animate the exit animations. I'm trying to remember what it was, but it was a project and, you know, the modal had some hooks that ran and fetched some data and did some logic. And if it's always rendered, even though it's visually hidden, but those hooks are running, you can get yes. into some really weird situations.
You start wiring up effects to detect when
it's like actually modal, shown.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you approximate its unrendering by using an effect to say, okay, the ID changed or something. So I need to like, I don't have like an on mount animation. Which I get, or sorry, an on-mount data fetch. Mm-hmm.
No, that's I'm brutal. You React component lifecycles are part of the programming model. Like when you navigate away from a page and come back, you expect the state to be reset. That's part of the mental model for building a React app.
Well, I'm trying to think of this as like, okay, so with like hooks, when hooks were introduced, that's like they kind of tackle that classic bug where you do work and component did mount. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden now your component can get an ID that changes. Mm-hmm. But since you did a bunch of work in component mm-hmm. mount, mm-hmm. your ID is changing. So you have like the wrong data with the wrong ID mm-hmm. and like effects and hooks were like a really nice answer to this. When the ID changes, you run this code.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if like just.
It's a sign your code is wrong.
Not the sign my code is wrong, but like more like, is it really that bad to have effects? Is it really that bad to just keep your components always rendered?
I think it is because there are times you rely on that behavior. For example, you render a form and you pass it in like a model that you fetched and you want the form to capture the initial version of the model.
Yep.
So that was one thing where we ran into. Actually, I think I ran into this with a select. So you're selecting like the exercise or something and you hit edit or new and you want to add a new one for that thing. But you haven't thought about what happens when the category changes because that's never a situation that could happen in that component. And so you don't want it to see that data for formic, which is captured and supposed to be captured by formic and not change after it is started because you start editing it until the user actually clicks edit or add or whatever.
Yep.
So I think, and also just components can have side effects, right? That's where they use effect. Let's say you want to have some tracking analytics when the modal is clicked. And it has a use effect that runs. You don't want that to run until the person clicks subscribe and the modal shows up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And so now you're tracking.
Like, you're using some proxy
is showing. Exactly. And did the ID change?
But you should be able to use mounting as an ID. Yeah, yeah. You know, think how many components on routes that we have that do that.
Yep.
And then when you leave away from them, you shouldn't have to add code that's like, I'm not on this route anymore. It just takes care of it. It unmounts. Right. even affects having a cleanup function mount.
That's our mental model. Like when I go away, this whole thing is cleaned up.
Cleanup functions will run. Like how would you run a cleanup function in effect if you did this? You'd have to
It would be based off like the is showing and the ID.
Exactly.
That
so
in.
Yeah.
So, just before we go too far down this, you can also use key, which is the thing I've used.
Yes.
So you just key the component. So like the component gets like a natural life cycle based off the ID changing. That can sometimes be confusing though.
Right.
Just because you're, you have to have a stable ID that you can key off of.
Right.
And you don't always have that. So.
Right. No, Animate Presence is awesome. And I think eventually we won't need something like that to exist because part of the whole design behind Suspense is the ability to animate components in and out and to let them like basically suspend. So right now, the whole reason these are hacks, even a hack in Ember, because as soon as you unrender something, the node is destroyed.
Right.
Suspense is going to enable animations at a core, at a more core level in React, including exit animations. So, I mean, Animate Presence might still exist, but it won't need to do the same hacks.
Wait, I'm having a hard time understanding that. If I have like a is showing and div I'm showing.
Yeah.
As soon as is showing goes to false.
What if the component like suspends or something on its way out?
But then I like, don't I trigger the suspense fallback at that point?
Well, there's some way that it has, I can pull up the threads, but there's some way, just like a component can say it's not ready yet and it can start preparing itself. It can start unmounting itself, and that can take time, and that can be part of this whole like coordinated thing. So there's no API for it yet, but it's part of it influenced the design of Suspense.
I guess you know how you can do a transition and there's like work that I don't know. You do a transition, there's like work that happens, but the old UI is kept around.
Right.
So maybe you do some transition, there's work that's happening that gives you time to animate it. Yep. I have no idea how that would work or what the API is, but that's okay. That's cool.
Oh, yeah. No, I was talking about it on Twitter with Dan Abramov and Josh Cuomo, who does a lot of animation stuff. And Dan was saying that's a big part of it. And Josh was saying he was excited about that because animations are, they're hard today in React in the sense that you do have to learn. You feel like you have to use a library.
Hacks. Yeah,
there's no first class way. The way like Svelte has a first class way to support unmount animations and Svelte Kit, that stuff is built in and you can customize it. React has no first class way to do that.
Dude, the frame of motion stuff is awesome. But the fact that you have to like clone.
Yes.
And it is like,
it's imagine if you could just like, I don't know, await or whatever, animate out. You know,
I need more time.
Yeah.
I need time to prepare my exiting. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's really
super cool. Yeah. But all that to say, no, I think that was a good point, and I love that the Animate Presence stuff. Basically, unless you have an extremely good reason not to, your slide outs and popovers and menus and modals should unmount if they're not shown visually. In general, your UI, if it's not visually displayed, it shouldn't be mounted in your React tree. That helps other developers in your team leverage the mental model that already exists in React, which is that things can happen on mount and things can happen on unmount. And just because you need to add animations shouldn't change the way you think about building that UI.
That's good.
And Animate Presence lets you do that. So that's nice.
Good. Yeah. That's good. It changes how you think about it. Yeah.
And I've used Animate Presence with other libraries like Headless UI and other ones that don't support this out of the box because those delegate. Well, for Headless UI, first of all, works for both Vue and React. So it can't solve that for everything. But also, like, Animate Presence is already a great solution for that problem for React. And we did the same thing in Ember. Like in Ember, we went through this as well. Is showing fly out versus composing it with an if. You know, it's the same thing. And tools exist for all these frameworks now that let you animate in and out, even if you're doing that. So that's a good little point. It's a good refactor. If you come across like a fly out with an is showing true prop in your code base, change it to be
Animate Presence.
Animate Presence with an if is show, you know, is showing and fly out. Because then you get to leverage, the React model. So that's a great little point.
It also makes you realize, too, when you come across an and in your code base, it's like, oh, I can animate this.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like a daunting task.
Exactly.
Like, oh, I have to refactor this to is showing prop and all this stuff.
Exactly. It's also But the general idea with not just mount and unmount animations, but any animation is like, you should really have your UI work first, then code it the way you want it to, like code it the best, cleanest way you can, and then layer animations on. Ideally, animations shouldn't affect your code much at all. Sometimes you end up adding more structure to the HTML if you need to like orchestrate. But in terms of like the state, the way the state and the behavior move, you shouldn't have to change anything about that. So if you already come into a code base, like you said, that has and you want to add animations, you should be able to.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Same with like a list of items. Your teammate's already mapping over a list of items. Boom, you know.
It's also nice when you're removing an item from a list. It's that bread and butter React pattern that you just find the item and set a new list without that item.
Right.
That all stays the same. It's you're wrapping the UI pieces with Framer Motion.
Exactly.
Which is
also a reason why it shows you why keys are important for lists. Because
now you can tell which element got removed.
Exactly. If you use like a key as an index as a key in a list of items and you remove one of them, it would be fine. You wouldn't notice it in a world without animations. Let's say if there was no if there was no browser state. So I have this app where you have like a list of items as forms, and you could start typing in one of them. And if you add it, you would notice because the text would move. But in a typical case where you're just showing like to-dos, you complete one of them, it's just going to go away and it'll re-render the whole list. But you've actually changed the identity of each one of those when it shouldn't. It should be tied to to-do.id. So if you add animations to the list and you fade out the removing one, but you're using index as a key, you'll see the wrong thing fade out. And the things won't move the way they're supposed to. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
I guess that's another case where like animations encourage you to have like more correct code, which is kind of what your original point was.
Yeah.
Because more, like identity is important. It's not always clear why until you have something like ephemeral DOM state that is lost because the identity changes, or you're animating, which depends on identity.
It feels, I agree with everything you're saying. Obviously I brought this up. It does feel a little strange in like the world of hooks saying, like talking about lifecycle. Cause I thought like the whole thing was like, we're thinking about lifecycle causes bugs. And
I think it's obvious that there's still lifecycle. There's still a notion of a component being rendered or unrendered.
I mean, there's definitely still life cycle because the way we as developers talk about our apps, we think of components as having lifecycle.
And, you know, Dan and the core team and the docs talk about you want to clean up a subscription when you unmount a component. That is a lifecycle. I mean, how else would you think about that? You know, it's like a gateway to the imperative world that like you're opening and closing things. When do you do that? But it's like a declarative wrapper. So like if you're looking at it, you don't have to think about it. But the practical world is like, the real world is we do have to write those imperative calls. And so, you know, a lot of animation gets to that zone as well, where you end up doing imperative stuff. You know, I will say I looked at like the Ionic library, Ionic framework. And their animation code's pretty cool because they definitely layer it in. Like it's actually in a different module and it's like a series of steps. And it's always cool to me because it would be nice sometimes, you know, just like I wanted like with Tailwind to be able to collapse the class name attribute so you don't see all the Tailwind classes. If we're just talking about behavior and want to understand the behavior of this, I just want to look at like the divs and like see the click handlers and the state flowing through. Right, because they're mixing concerns. I mean, it's all the concerns together, but sometimes you're only caring about the behavior or only caring about the styling. Sometimes when you add the complex animations, you have the same thing. You have a lot of motion properties, you have variant code, you have all these things. It was cool in Ionic to look through their components and see like the module enter and exit are like just separate modules, and they just like literally somehow like splat them in and layer them in. Separate. And so it makes it easy to read because you're just looking at the animations. It's just interesting.
It's React.
Yep. It's all in React.
Cool.
I don't think they use Framer or Framer Motion. I don't know, but it's more of like a series of imperative steps, you know, but, it's like cancelable and everything. I mean, it's really, really super solid. The project is like several years old at this point. And it like mimics all the iOS animations. It's where I got like the easing curves for like the modal that fades in the background and stuff and comes up.
Oh,
because they match Apple's easing curves.
That's pretty cool.
It's really cool. Yeah. But anyways, just another thought there. Why don't you talk about the Stork client side search? I don't know what the heck this is about.
We're working on a consulting project now, and one of my tasks this week was to get search working. They had some old search code.
Isn't that great to be a product manager? Get search working. Very declarative, you know?
Yeah.
Just make search work. Talk about declarative programming.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the true declarative programmers.
Exactly.
They had a bunch of search code that existed. It was just me updating it to like new UI, getting bits moved or whatever. But all search I've ever implemented has been just search that comes from like a back end. Like the front end basically hobbles together some query of like words to search for and fires it off somewhere, and some results come back from the internet.
Yeah,
You don't ask any questions.
Declarative search.
Yeah, declarative search. You know, and then there's like tools like Agolia, which are great. I mean, they're awesome. You get a little widget. You pay. You've actually implemented this.
Yeah, Mirage.
So you get a little widget you paste in, and they index your site behind the scenes without you knowing, and you can bring up their search dialog. This search that I was working on is really cool. It uses this library called Stork, and the way that Stork works is it's client-side search. So at build time, it builds a search index of everything on your site, and you can tell it where to get data
from.
So you can say, like, I have a bunch of markdown files.
Uh-huh.
You can say, I have a bunch of HTML files, and you can tell it like where the content lives in the HTML. So you can say it's all under like the article tag. You can give it like JSON files. You can build up your own kind of like strings for it to search for. If you're using Next.js, you can, and you're using like get static props, you can actually read all the props.
Oh, cool.
That you're,
because you have it at build time.
I might be like some private APIs in there, but, uh-huh, but you can like read all the props that get static props and used.
Cause they're available.
Cause they're available at build time to build up your search index. So you,
you're saying they're reading from like the build folder or something.
You can, right. But it's there. Right. I mean, you know, you can work this stuff out.
Yeah.
You can build, you basically define how to find all your files. And then there's a CLI tool that runs, and it builds up a search index. Mm-hmm. And that file is like a WASM file, super compressed. And you put that in like your public folder.
Oh, wow.
And then your client, basically there's a Stork JavaScript side. And that's what you load on the browser. The client.
Yeah.
And that's like this, I think that's a thing that's written in WASM, and that pulls in the index you built.
Oh, it doesn't even fetch it. It doesn't even go to the public file at request time. It pulls it in. So it's all client.
No, I think you do request, because it gives you like a .st file, and you put that up, in like your public folder. Mm-hmm. And then, you basically, when you load the Stork, you know, you new Stork, you load the Stork, JavaScript module, you point it at an ST file.
Mm-hmm.
But then from there, it has the index.
That's cool.
And it does search, and it's actually unreal how fast it is.
Yeah, it's like it's fuzzy finding on your VS Code or something like that. It is
so, so fast. And like, yeah, I was thinking about like a lot of the doc sites I work on, like they're just markdown files.
Dude, this was part of MRCLI add-on docs.
But yeah.
Yeah, do you remember? This is exactly what we did in MRCLI add-on docs. Do you remember?
Built an index?
Yes, someone else did it. Do you remember what was it called? There's those two libraries, like day and night or moon. What are those search libraries?
This is the first. That's so funny because this is the first time I was like, "Does this work?" And it does.
It's called Lunar, a bit like Solar, but much smaller and not as bright. So yeah, Lunar and Solar is a simple search index that can be created using the following. So you just, you call it this dot app.
I've used Solar. That's okay. Like a back end thing that you send over. It builds your index on the back end and then you send requests.
So the guy who did this whole feature, so MRCLI add-on docs was like, imagine like you have a library and you install it, and it gives you like an instant doc site. And it looks at like all of your Ember objects that you were exporting and makes like JS doc descriptions for them in the web or whatever. And and it lets you write demos in like what was the equivalent of basically MDX.
You could do
MDX like, basically. So you had like a UI drop down and you could write like basically an MDX thing as part of your markdown to show live demos. You could write tests against it. So it did all that stuff. But one of the things it did was it had search built into it, just like in any like docs that you would expect. And it did that by indexing all of the JS doc comments for your APIs for all your classes and all the markdown guides that you had written.
Okay.
And so all the headings. So it did all of that. At build time, when you ran Ember Build, Ember Deploy, whatever, did that, build the index, put it in there, and then the search hit it. It was exactly the same thing I'm describing. Yeah. Super cool. And that's why it's instant on those sites. If you look at it. Yeah, it's super cool. It is
unbelievable. And
it's like you said, it makes sense. If there's 20 blog posts or whatever, it's fine. You know, just do it all on the client. Super fast. And the index is pretty small, right?
I think even if you...
had like 100 or 200 or something.
I know they said they spent like a lot of time, the people that developed Stork, it's optimized to be small and fast. Mm-hmm. There's lots of call outs to like using WASM. And so I don't know
affects it. It's nice not having any like any network dependencies, any, you know.
Just any like, I was thinking about like Agoli is awesome. Like it is, it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's also like, we might have to update stuff.
Right.
We have it. Yeah, exactly.
We have to pay for it. You have to install it. It's third party changes. Yep.
For like my OSS doc site.
Yeah.
I don't like, it's not big enough. I don't need that. Like if I can build a client side index and it's like snappy.
Yeah.
I thought it was really cool.
Super cool.
I'm definitely going to play with it some more. I think I'm going to bring it in
to your next year.
Some docs and just, I don't know. It's always kind of like, wait, building an index client side has always just been like, I guess it could work, but do you really want to do that? And after this, like playing it with this week and
that's awesome.
Actually building this feature and
That's really cool.
I think it's super awesome.
No, that's neat. I didn't know, I had never heard of Stork before. So
they have a bunch of demos. One of the really cool demos is you can take a YouTube URL and you like append something to it, like .srt or something. And you get a transcript that's just generated from YouTube. And so they build, they take this three blue, one brown channel.
That's a great channel.
And they download all the transcripts.
The captions?
Yeah,
the transcript files.
And they build an index. And then and they say like, type in this text box right here. And I was just typing. And it was, I was just blown
it would
away.
It would go to the point in the video or it would just show you
Yes.
Oh, it could
go because they had the subtitle. So they would go to T equals, you know how you can append like T equals
to
YouTube?
Yeah.
But not only that, like you're just typing in this text box and you're typing for like derivative.
Yeah.
It just shows you like
all parts. This
text and then like the word derivative is highlighted.
That's pretty cool.
It's like fast. Like you can't do that on YouTube. Now, like
yeah.
you can't, like you do a search.
Yeah,
I'm sure YouTube is searching transcripts, but I don't know.
That was so like, when you do that, it takes a second to build it at the beginning, and then you're searching on. It's building an on-demand index for
you build the index.
Okay, right.
Right.
So but I'm saying the YouTube thing was doing it for one video at the time of request.
I think he had published. So I actually don't know. I'm guessing he had built.
A few videos as an example.
He had built an index as part of his build step.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I was thinking like searching your YouTube channel. Was like, that'd be really cool. Like you could type in D3 and you'd go to your last video.
And see right where.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty awesome.
I would be like, I mean, there's like a lot of good stuff.
That's pretty cool.
Dude, like the Ember Map videos we made.
I was going to say, that's what I was thinking. In Ember Map, you could type in like declarative and see.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. Like
right to the time.
That's pretty cool.
And it's like, so like there's...
That's really cool, actually.
There's like all these like artifacts that we have, and we have these tools that are like really good at building websites now.
Yeah.
And so we can just kind of layer these things into our build step. And it's like, I guess it's... I don't know. I need to play with it more.
That's really getting me thinking. The video stuff would be awesome. It'd be cool. I mean, we're working on this frame of motion course. What if you could type in animate presence? See every part of every video where we use animate presence. Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
That'd be really neat.
Yeah. And I know that like, I know YouTube can like auto-generate captions, subtitles, whatever.
Yep.
Transcript, whatever it's called. But I know like AWS has a service that does this. And it's like for the types of stuff we make, it would probably take like 10 cents to get everything.
So. Right. That's really cool. Stork. Interesting. All right. Yeah. I'll have to put that link in the show notes as well, but I'm going to check that out. It seemed pretty well maintained, the library.
Yeah, it did. Docs were good. You know, it's like your typical OSS.
Yeah.
Creator
has really moved to Nepal and it's like herding goats or whatever.
Yeah.
No. You get what you get.
I'm really excited to play with it.
That's awesome.
I do all this markdown build stuff. Yep. Why not?
Yep.
Just index expand it. That. Yep. Like I already build HTML. Why not build a search index?
Yep.
So
no, man, I we put a lot of time into add-on docs that we always thought would be fun to part of the power of add-on docs was like everyone making libraries in the Ember community had a lot of shared foundations. And so you could make a lot of assumptions about it, but, it would always be neat to have that sort of thing for like React community or just more general JavaScript. I know there's some tools that do that, but we even built a different index per version. So every time you publish a new version of NPM, you'd redo the index. So if you were on a version part of your docs and you'd search, it would be searching that version of the docs.
It's like automatic version docs.
Automatic version docs with search.
Like you put the old docs
exactly in an archive folder. And then that way, like, yeah, pretty neat. Pretty neat.
Really cool.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. Yeah. That makes me want to build some stuff with it for sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Why don't we wrap up with a quick discussion about merge commits? So we ran into this case with our consulting project, and it got us talking about merge commits versus rebase. Now, we've both had our editors configured in such a way for years now that whenever we do git pull, let's say we're working on a branch, by default, git will rebase our commits on top of the remote. So
if we go to pull in main into our feature branch, we basically take all of main, get all of main, and then we replay our commits on top of that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I'm trying to remember the reason we started doing that. The actual reason. So it's nice because, you know, I used to do a lot more open source. I don't do any of these days, but
well, I know one reason.
If you're looking at, let's say you start working on a new feature in your library, you want to see the commit history and the changes between that and main. And main gets updated and now you look back and there's changes that are not there. So you want to update it, right? And so the default way, I think, if you were to just set up a new computer and install Git and like do things would be, when you kind of pull main back into your branch, it would do a merge commit. So now you're looking at your feature and you have like, you know, wrote a test, added this new API, and then it's like merged from master. And it's weird because it has that code. But if you click on files changed, you wouldn't see the stuff that was changed in main since you started. There was a very good reason that we started doing this.
I think it's when you look at the, I think there's two. There's one, when you look at the Git history, you have this weird zigzag of commit on main, my commit on main, and they're all kind of merged into each other. It's hard. It looks like these two things are happening in parallel because in time, in like real world time, they are happening in parallel.
Right. But conceptually, like you want yours to be added once you're ready to merge it.
Right. And then we didn't always have squash and merge.
Right.
So we would want all of our like 10 commits for the feature on top, and then we might rebase
them. Maybe that's what it was.
Into like one. We'd always rebase
that. That's probably what it was. Yeah. So we wanted clean PRs. And so if you have merge commits while you're working, and then you try to squash them, it's really weird because now you're merging into, it doesn't really work, does it?
I think you want to say like squash the last 10 commits.
You can't squash with the merge commits in there. And it also changes your like SHA. So you're not really, you kind of divert the tree because like you're not playing off the same base anymore because you've merged in these new, like here's where you diverge, but now you're merging these in. And so when you squash all these down, you don't share the base anymore. So you can't squash them all and then get a clean one PR merge. So the way, I think that's probably why we did it. So then we would just always rebase. And that forced you to deal with conflicts along the way, but that's good because you want to know if your changes affect, if any changes that had happened since you started work on your feature branch affect the changes you're making. You resolve those. And then back in the day, before we merged, we would do a git rebase dash I head tilde, however many commits there were, squash them all down, and then you'd have your PR that goes in. Then GitHub added the feature that lets you click squash and merge. So even if you have a messy commit history, which is nice because now you have like the back and forth, maybe someone asks for a review, you change it, you keep that history, but then when you click squash and merge and you look in the main branch, you only have one commit. And so what happened this week was that,
and the awesome thing about that, just the awesome thing about that is that one commit usually has a, like a number 47
yes.
linking back to the PR. So you can click on that and see the real history, all the work that went into it, which is great.
So what happened this week is that this was happening and we've been working on a long running branch, which is also a hard, you know, thing that's, if you have control over it, you don't want to do it, but
you always think, no, we can manage it. We can manage it.
Yeah.
It's no problem. Yeah. And then like, you're just like, oh, long running branches.
It's better to ideally use like a feature flag or something.
It's hard. I mean, it's hard. There's trade-offs.
So, there's actually this button in GitHub that lets you like update main into this, and we clicked that and it basically created a merge commit, which is not rebasing and not what we had been doing the whole time to keep our branch up to date with main. And so we were like, oh, should we undo that? So it got us thinking. One of the bad things about doing the interactive rebase is always a risk is that when you go and do that, you are changing history. So you are actually losing history potentially in the event of a conflict, basically. If you don't have a conflict, doesn't matter. If you're only working on files that aren't changed with the new changes from main, the rebase, interactive, whatever, just the rebase will literally just pull your commits out, move the base of your branch to the new tip of head, and then play yours on top, and nothing happens. So I think they all get new SHAs. Because you're changing it.
Because aren't they based off the last SHA?
Exactly. And so they do get new SHAs. So you are rewriting those things, but you haven't lost any work potentially or at all. I think there's no possible way for that to happen. There might be a possible way. I'm pretty sure there's no way though. And the problem comes in with the conflict. So let's say you go to rebase and you are both messing with a page called about.js. And then you go and resolve the conflicts. Well, what if you did a bad job resolving it? There's resolution. Conflict resolution is error prone. Like it's a human process. And you might do like theirs and ours and then realize it overwrote some things. There's just information that could be lost.
Or you just do what I sometimes do and you
click the wrong theirs.
You leave the conflict in there and you have all these like, you know,
does Git let you commit when you do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Ask me how I know.
So if you do that and you've rebased, let's say like you click theirs instead of ours, you literally lost your work and then you commit it and you click rebase continue. Well, now you have all your nice and tidy commits playing on top of the tip of main, but you've literally lost your work. It's not anywhere. It's gone. So the merge commit.
Well, there was another thing you said that light bulbed it for me. And that is if you have a conflict, and you take all your commits out, resolve the conflict, and then play your commits on top. And then let's say like the build breaks. The app no longer works.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
The app no longer works. You can no longer go back one at a time.
To where you were right before you did that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you undo the first commit, it's going to be your latest commit. And you would in fact undo all of your commits.
Yes.
Until you got to the head of main.
Exactly.
And then from there, you can test like, does a head of main build, but that doesn't tell you. And then you can start replaying your commits on it, but it doesn't tell
exactly.
You exactly. You don't know if you did a bad commit,
or if something changed in part of main that broke the build. Exactly. Yeah. So exactly. So the potential for data loss is in the conflict resolution. If you resolve the conflict and then you get there and something doesn't work exactly like you said. Is it because something in main changed that affects the code you wrote, or is it because you messed up the conflict resolution? You have no way of knowing. And if your app just worked before you started this whole process, you cannot go back to that snapshot of the build, which would help you diagnose it. So
that's it.
If something in your environment had changed, you can't undo your rebase because you literally rewrote history.
You can't go back to your version of that. You can exactly. go back to main.
Yes.
And you can go back to like your last commit
yes.
with all the other commits played off yes. on main, but you can't
go back to the version before the yeah. rebase.
So you basically, if you did this today on Thursday, you can't go back to what was the world like Thursday. On Wednesday.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
So
yeah, that was a yeah. thing. Because I was not understanding why don't we just rebase,
right.
resolve the conflicts.
Right.
But yeah. Yep.
So then the other option is a default, which is creating a merge commit, which is a feature of Git that again happens by default. So you just merge in main, and now your history has these points in time where you merge in the changes to main. But that way, if you merge in the changes to main, you might still have a conflict, which you still need to resolve. But it creates a new shot on top of the work you've already done, which stays at the same shot and the same point in time in which you actually did it.
And
if you mess up the merge, if the conflict, which is still error prone, it's still a part of the process. If you mess it up, you can literally undo it. You can check out head-1, see if your app works or not. And then if it doesn't, you know if it was that commit or if something in your environment changed or something like that. So, and then you can check main and see if it works. And then you can know it's something to do with that. You can look at that merge, you can see it. So
there's
no history changing. It's safer. And I think the main benefit of rebasing was squashing for a clean history for the purpose of PRs and open source projects, especially when you wanted to just be able to see the final thing. That was it, because I was like documenting changes in Mirage, and you go and look at the change log, and it's like all these things everywhere. Because yeah, you like have one commit from one PR, one commit from another PR, because they're happening in parallel. You just want to see when the feature was merged. Conceptually, that's when the code was added to main. You didn't care that half it was done a month ago, and you didn't want that to be in your main thing. So with the button added in GitHub, which is squash and merge, which works even with this merge commit, takes all the code, it does create a single clean commit that happens at the point in time when you click squash and merge. I'm wondering if there's any reason to do rebasing anymore, because it is more risky.
Well, if the squash and merge, I've never done the merge commits and then do a squash and merge. I've only done the rebase and then squash mm-hmm. and merge. But like, let's just assume that everything works how we're thinking it works.
I'm pretty sure it does, because I looked in the app, which is a big app we're working on, and that's I think how everyone else is doing it.
Okay. So I think in that case we shouldn't
rebase.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any reason to
rebase anymore, which is what we do.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah,
it's like my whole identity is being shaken, shattered in front of my eyes. I was such a team rebaser for so long. Like, what am I going to do?
Yeah,
I have to take down the posters in my room.
I think the thing.
Change my license plate. It says hashtag team.
I know you're making fun of this right now, but like, I think the thing that bothers me the most is like, you would like, I've just worked on projects where people are like, don't rebase, it's bad. And you're like, why is it bad? And
yeah.
they're like, they don't, they're just, yeah. they're parroting, don't rebase.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's always like upset me, but I guess they're right.
It always is more, it was definitely always more risky, but as a maintainer, it was a burden on me to have a messy history in main, because it affected how I documented it, being able to find, you know, past things. And so I wanted to make sure that the burden was on the person working on the feature, whether it was me or someone else, to submit a clean PR that when looked at could show the history of it easily. And so that's when the risk of rebasing was worth it for me. But I don't know if that's true, if you can just squash it with the merge commits.
You want to be able to check out main and type, we have an alias, it's like get log with 2 G's,
yeah,
but it's exactly. something with like,
exactly.
You want to be able to read that.
Exactly. Where
if you pull up that tree on projects,
you want to see, whoops, worker in progress. You don't want to see that in main.
I mean, you just can't,
yeah.
you can't tell.
It's not useful.
Yeah.
It's exactly. like an abstraction around a PR.
Yeah.
One commit. And then if you want to dive deeper, you go to the PR and you see all the commits.
Yep. I'm thinking based on this conversation that we won't, we'll remove that rebasing from our
Git config.
From our Git
config. Yeah, I want to talk to some people, but yeah. I'm curious. If you listen to this and you have any thoughts, I'm really curious to know. Because I still feel like there might have been some other reason for doing it, but I think that was it. I think that's what I was forgetting was that we started squashing manually with Git rebase dash I for interactive locally before merging PRs on our open source projects.
The only thing that we haven't done this process is we have not
tried to squash and merge,
with a whole bunch of
merge commits.
Yeah. And but I'm guessing based off what we read that you'll be able to basically take the diff that's
in your PR
and just play that as one single commit.
Right. Conceptually, like even if you have merge commits, those show code you didn't write as part of that PR. But when you click files change, it's comparing your PR to the tip of head and it won't have any of the changes that are also like there. That is your commit. Yeah. And if that's what that button's doing, then that's exactly what we want. So,
you know, what's really cool about this is that you can do both of those steps from the GitHub UI.
Very cool.
So you can go to your PR and you can say update based off main, which is your merge commit.
Yep. And if it was a conflict, it would show you. You could edit it in the editor.
And then you can also click squash and merge.
Yeah.
So the fact that our whole process is now two button clicks. We've been replaced by two buttons.
Hopefully soon more can be replaced. make search.
Yeah.
Just type into an AI text field.
Oh man, I gotta tell this. I was working on like content for one of our client projects, and there was just a bunch of placeholder text. And I'm awful, dude. I'm like your typical programmer. I'm just awful at writing, awful at spelling. And there was all this placeholder text, and it was, you know, the text would say
lorem ipsum.
So, yeah, lorem ipsum, or some text here that's like 4 to 5 words, and it like okay, I really want to get something like real in there. So I went to GPT-3 mm-hmm. and I said, I kid you not, I'm working on a website that's about X, Y, and Z. Please write me a one-line description for this page. And it came back. And if I didn't like it, I could just rerun the query. And like every single time, I was working on a whole bunch of different pages.
Yeah.
Every single time, I would only have to rerun the query like 2 or 3 times. And I would get something that I was like, wow. Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
It was so cool.
Dude, you know what that just made me think of? How cool it would be. You know, we used to do like a lot of Mirage and Faker stuff. Wouldn't it be cool if you could choose a seed, click, you know, give me, 10 JavaScript objects with key, basically your factories. But even if it was a function, instead of having to use Faker, you just like shell out to GPT-3, create an article that's 10 paragraphs long about oil, you know, and the economy, boom. And then like,
instead of be reading the article and like circling things like that's just blatantly wrong. Yeah,
exactly. Dude, that's pretty good though. And then you could use a seed like the same way you do with Faker if you like the one you got and lock it in so it's the same. For testing, for visual diffs, you don't want it to regenerate every time. You want random data, but you want it to be consistently random. You know what I mean?
Or you seed it, and when you're happy with it, you write just, it to a fiction file.
Right.
That style
thing. Yeah, but that'd be pretty awesome.
I want to play with this more.
That'd be pretty cool. It'd be good for Figma has ways to generate fake data, and like you loop over 10 avatars and they just pull them from like
UI faces.
Yeah, exactly. Or Unsplash or whatever. That would be pretty awesome.
Cool. There's something that's important about like having high fidelity data.
Totally.
So
yeah, pretty interesting stuff. That's pretty neat. That would be awesome. That'd be really awesome. I mean, we do so many demos for like our videos and stuff. It'd just be cool. You know, events for a calendar. Like, give me 30 calendar events with random dates between, you know, now and next year. And
it's pretty cool because you know how like when you're doing the Faker stuff, there's like that you have first name, last name.
Yep.
And then you want to generate an email and it will do like first.last@
AOL.com.
Yeah. but like mail. Getting like when you have like the AI generate this, it's like
they could have a picture and a name and an email that matches it. They live in LA because they look like they, you know, plastic surgery or whatever.
But it should. Okay. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid here, but it should, if the person's 20 years old, it would probably be a picture.
Or
it would have a
Gmail. If it's old, they'd have AOL.com.
There you go.
Higher household income. No, basically like if you told, you know, it's again, declarative programming. If you told like your minion, you know, you're a 20-year-old, 22-year-old, like, junior developer, like, go get me a bunch of high fidelity data. What would they do? Realistic. That's what you want to do.
It. They would
look at make it realistic like, avatars or whatever. So that'd be pretty awesome.
Really cool.
It's like, there's a lot of potential there. That could be a pretty cool business, honestly, if you had a really easy way to do that. Anyways, just thinking in the clouds.
This is the point of the podcast where we've gone too far.
Yeah, it is. Yep, no one's listening anymore. Cool. Well, hey, that was fun. Look at us, 2 weeks in a row. We'll be back next week. Hopefully, I have some more updates about our frame of motion course.
Yeah.
Because we've been working on that. And I'm going to be shooting a video tomorrow, a little frame of motion tip about animating a carousel. So maybe I'll have some fun to talk about then.
Cool.
Awesome. All right. Hey, if this is your first time, front end first, we talk about web stuff, React, Tailwind, JavaScript. Who knows what else? The Celtics.
Auto-generated AI.
I'm Sam.
I'm Ryan.
And thanks for joining. We'll see y'all next week.
See ya.
Bye.